Welcome to session 2 of 3. The stuff I'm teaching this week has to do with feeling, how do you feel more like approaching difference than running away from it? What are the things we understand about the dilemma that we talked about on Monday? It's mostly to do with identity. We wonder who we are, we wonder who they are, and we're not sure we can bridge the two. Tonight we're talking about ourselves mainly as kind of the fallible instruments at the center of everything. That when we find ourselves in situations that feel unfamiliar to us, what are things we can predict about how we are going to respond, and then how could we respond other if we want to respond other? So that's tonight. And on Friday, we're just going to say, here's how to do it. So that's as close as I can come to a process that feels like it works. We'll do the how-to session on Friday, and you'll be an important part of that how-to session because you'll be fixing up all the hows and the twos. As we work with a couple different resources that we've got. Come in and be comfortable wherever you like. There's still room. We can pull up another chair. We can't pull one up here. 6 is the most we could take at any one of the circles. Do you have 6 there?
You
got
7.
We have 5.
We can try 7. Let's see how much we have there. So join one of them. This one has 5, but I pull up another chair.
I really didn't go back.
Anybody who comes in after we start is going to be observed. My name's Jeff, by the way. My last name looks funny. It scares the hell out of people. I was born Jeff Kirsten. I married a grip 25 years and 3 weeks ago, so I got the grip at the end, and she got the Kirsten on the front. So my students over time have told me that if they think of a plumbing tool, a medieval disease, or a wrestling hold, they can pronounce my last name, which is Kirsten Grip. Like, oh no, hand me that cursing grip, would you? Oh no, the cursing grip. You know, the easiest way to pronounce my name is always Jeff, so that's that one. I've been teaching in college for 33 years, I figured out this summer. And I've been teaching this material since 1998. So this is something I know well and I love well. I think it's at the center of what I like to do. What we're going to be doing in this space with each other here is we're going to play a game. And so I have all of the materials you need for the game here. And in a minute, we'll get you set up with so that you can learn the game and start playing it with each other. And then I'll tell you a little bit more as we move along today. We're going to do 2 things today. Basically, we're going to play a game, and then I'm going to come in, put my social science hat on, and we'll do some sense making about the game. So first thing I'd like you to do, it looks like you've sort of nodded to the other people in your group and you've made their acquaintance. That's lovely. What you'll find there in front of you, we're going to play a card game. It uses just half the deck of cards, and I pre-sorted the cards. You've got a half-size deck, and it's just beautifully sorted for you there. What I'm going to ask you to do is you're going to get 5 minutes with the instructions, and that's all you get. You get 5 minutes with the instructions. And then I'm going to take them away, and you're going to play the game with each other. In this circle here. So the instructions are on the green sheets there. There are only 5 green sheets per table, so you might have to look on with one of the other folks if you're in a group of 6 or whatever you've got there. But I'm going to start timing that right now. So go ahead and take out the green sheets. Have a look. Once you feel like you've got your heads around it, go ahead and do a practice deal and give it a try. And just as soon as you feel like you're ready, a best way to learn it is just to deal the cards and try that. See how it works. Somebody collect all the green sheets in your group so I can just grab them in a bundle. All right, folks. Let me tell you what's going to happen next. I didn't tell you this earlier, but we're actually going to have a tournament. Americans love tournaments. So the first spot you're going to play is with these people you learned the game with. So you're just going to stay at this table, you're going to deal in, and this time you're going to keep score. You're going to keep track of who does best and who does worst. And, at the end of the round, you'll be shifting. So if you are the best player in your group, you take the most tricks over the course of your playing time, you move clockwise to the next table. If you are the worst player in your group, you move counterclockwise. If there's any tie, then the 2 best move clockwise, the 2 worst move counterclockwise. And then we'll have another round of the game. Here's the other major catch, is you are no longer allowed to speak to each other at all.
No?
You're no longer allowed to speak to the other players at all. So you're allowed to do, you can do sign language if you want to, you can do little symbols if you want, but you may not speak, you may not use words with each other. Remember, we're talking about intercultural communication here, so we're trying it out as Americans, we're having a little tournament. So that's what's going to happen. At the end of the round, whoever you kind of toted up, see who the winners were. Winners move clockwise. Let's call them losers. Move counterclockwise. Alternate winners move counterclockwise. Just one table. And I know the tables are numbered 1 to 5, but if you're in, is this group 1? So if you're in group 5 and you're going down, you're actually heading for group 1 over here. I'll regulate when the rounds start and stop. There'll be kind of an amorphous length to the rounds. And you're welcome to shuffle and deal at any point now. Let's begin. No speaking. Laughing is fine. No sign language either. That's another kind of cheat. Okay, time to figure out your top player or players. Time to find out people at the other end of that spectrum. Top players, you're moving one group clockwise. Bottom players, you're moving one group counterclockwise. So that's, this is able to help. All right, I'm sorry. This is a game called Barnga. If you ever want to find it again, it's findable. B-A-R-N-G-A. And it's explicitly designed to let you suss out what it feels like to be in an unfamiliar situation. And there's only limited means to do anything about it. I took your words away. That's a really off-putting thing to lose, right? To lose half of your code, more than half of your code, right when you're launching into something that's puzzling the hell out of you. Can you name some of the emotions in the room?
Anger.
Pardon? Yeah.
Anger.
Anger, absolutely.
Frustration.
Frustration. Confusion.
Laughter.
Laughter. So merriment.
Capitulation.
More. Yeah, there was some whatever in the room.
Power.
Power.
Brotherly.
Okay. Is that an emotion?
She claimed it.
I felt power.
You felt power. Can we unpack that one for a minute? Let's unpack the power one for a minute. Yeah. I felt powerful.
I took what I wanted. I didn't look people in the eye. I just played it the way I wanted to. As soon as I figured out within the first 3 minutes, 1 minute in the new group, that the rules were different, I decided I'm going to play by my rules, and I'm going to make them up as I go.
I'm just going to do what I do.
I had my radar on. I knew that, coming in, I knew there was something going that would engage some sort of power play, probably. So, turned on the radar, figured it out fast, and then ran with it.
So, on the plus side, there was some merriment. I heard some frustration, anger, confusion pieces. Was there anything else you felt on the sort of plus side?
Oh.
No.
There was some advocacy.
Oh yes.
I thought it was exciting that the rules kept changing. I thought it was interesting to try to that was the first part of the new game was trying to figure out what the rules were.
And that was kind of energizing for
me. Yeah, because I knew the rules over there, but I didn't know the rules over here. And so the first part of the game, after I figured out there was new rules, I was trying to look for other new rules, and then coming over here looking for new rules as well. Just kind of. That was interesting.
Who in the room had the opposite kind of feeling? Like as soon as the rules changed, your internal energy meter went down instead of up. Like you went, oh no.
The first time it was like, oh okay, we have different rules on this one thing, and that was fine, And then when it got more complicated, there were 3 different sets of rules at the table. It was just like, oh,
well, and there are rules in different senses. There was the card game rule, and then when I moved over here first, I thought, well, the majority should rule. And most of the people have been here. But by the third round, we only had one person who played by those original rules here. More of us had spades.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
So there were both game rules and process for playing the game rules that were going to negotiate.
Because I was never at the end of each round the best or the worst, I stayed here. So and then by the third time, I felt almost I had to defend the rules. This is how we play it here.
as we were distributing the last round, I thought, I should have stopped, and we should have, before we started, we knew we had different rules. Say, okay.
We tried to.
You tried that?
Did it work?
We did it.
We did do that.
How did that get started? Can I ask? How do you negotiate that when you don't have any words? How did you sit down and say,
I exercised a little power and grabbed the deck and found an ace.
And you didn't grab it from him?
No.
And laid them out and went,
I was frustrated.
true. Each group had different rules, different circumstances, just slightly. For some groups, aces were high. For some, they were low. For some, spades were trump. For some, diamonds were trump. For some, none were trump. So somebody's like playing a diamond going, in a group that doesn't have any kind of trump, they're thinking, what's wrong with you? What are you doing in the circumstance? But even when you could recognize that each group had slightly different rules, you couldn't necessarily know what those differences were. And even if you could figure out what the differences were, did you necessarily know what to do about them? Right? So what real life situations does this circumstance remind you of? Can you talk within your groups for just a second? Think about other situations where that sort of mimic this one for you. You're hardly ever in a situation where somebody says you can't use your language, but sometimes we're in a situation where our language is in effect.
Yeah.
But think of this one other situation you come up with where this is similar. Do you see this?
Yes.
Good. So, I'd like to go around from group to group. I asked each group to come up with at least one scenario that felt comparable to what this contrived game had you doing. Did you come up with one you felt like this reminded me of? What is it? Let's hear one of yours, and we'll get them all.
International travel, where you don't speak, they don't speak your language, and you don't know the customs and the rules and where to get the bus tickets and those kinds of things, and you can't ask anyone. And,
did you find yourself doing similar things here that you do in those situations? And if so, what were those things?
Well, I think, yes, you just do what you're familiar with. Well, back home, we get the, you know, we pay as you're getting on the bus, so you try that. Oh, there's no place to pay, and then you get yelled at, and so they tell you to get off the bus, and right. So you figure it out eventually. So.
Some trial and error. So, being in a new international situation, thank you. We'll come back for more of yours, this group.
Well, we did international travel too, but just to add new. So, being you're the new employee around the conference table, and you don't know whether you wait your turn or you're expected to jump in, and who has the trump? Who knows? It might not be the boss.
Right. Another great example. Middle group.
Well, mine was being a new pastor on Christmas Eve. You ask them what Christmas Eve needs to be like, but they don't need to know to tell you the givens because they're given.
They know who took it out. I played a band with a recovering church musician. Analogous situation?
When marrying into a new family, and you are the youngest person marrying the youngest child, and everyone else has already eclipsed you by another generation or younger, and then who makes the decisions about the aging parent who then comes to live with you and has other various problems?
Oh. This is all hypothetical.
That's a great example, Amy. That's a great example. It's right up the alley. The door group?
I like the hold of one.
Yeah.
Oh. Dish team.
Do you want a fake microphone? People sometimes have an easier time with it.
Oh, thank you very much, Carol. I was on dish team, and it had been years and years since I did it, and I walked in, and she said, do you want to do the dirty dishes? Okay. Go get your apron. I put my apron on, went over and I start scrubbing. And 10 minutes later, I'm told, you have to go change. You're wearing a sleeveless shirt. I'm like, I am. It's hot in here. I forgot to tell you the rules. I'm going, whose fault is it?
And we do go there, don't we? We think about whose fault is it? And especially in America, this is a culture, we're a really fault-oriented culture. You have one as well?
Oh, well, we all do.
Yeah, what is it?
Just the simple thing of going to school, like a child either entering kindergarten or going from elementary to middle school, high school, college. It's scary.
Yeah. I teach a lot of freshmen, and it feels like part of what I'm teaching them, here's what it means to college. It's different than high school. Others that haven't been spoken that came out in your groups, other analogous situations that felt like this one?
I thought historic, and having taught Chinua Achebe's Things Fall Apart about British imperialism, I, in my power role, felt like a British imperialist of the 19th century. I'm going to take what I want.
Yeah.
I'm a social worker and I worked with abusive and neglect kids or families where that happened, and we've had many immigrants who come here and the practices that they do are not acceptable, mm-hmm. and they get, CPS gets called and they're more shocked because they consider themselves good parents, but because they're at home they can do those things. Mm-hmm. It's pretty upsetting.
So. Yeah, my wife did that work for a long time.
There's
one.
One more. Two more. Three more. Start here.
Oh, I was just talking about, my mom lives close to me, and she's almost 80, and her world is shrinking, and the rules are changing with regard to that, and my rules are changing, too, and how I can interact with her, mm-hmm. in what ways are appropriate, and what ways I just need to let go of, because those things are gone, mm-hmm. What I can do, and everything's shrinking for her, you know, what she can eat, mm-hmm. what she can do, her memories. And mm-hmm. I have to change my rules to mine.
You're feeling your way a little bit in a way you haven't had to before.
Right.
Perfect.
Purple man.
I used to work for a coffee shop company, and I would go into stores that were having many issues, often communication being one of them, mm-hmm. and kind of jump in and deal with a lot of people speaking different languages. Mm-hmm. I was kind of surprised that other groups didn't figure out a common set of rules. Early on, the first, I started here and ended up over there and was trying to get group rules going early. And by the time I got here for the last round, I just took the cards until we all made a decision. So I was kind of surprised that, I mean, I think it's just something I was primed to do. It was surprising other groups to me didn't quickly realize something was amiss in a session where we're all confused.
There's a lot of laughter. Observers, what did you notice as you were watching people? I asked you to pay attention to what you noticed about people. What sort of stood out to you as outsiders that didn't even know the rules of the game?
Sure.
What did you see?
A lot of body language where people showed shock or dismay or more resignation.
Did you demo some? I saw resignation.
Over here.
You did a great one. At one point, you put your cards in and you just went.
I know that my reaction would have been different had there been something at stake.
Yes.
Sure.
So, yes.
But there was something at stake. It was a tournament, and we're Americans. Who can eat the most bugs?
As an observer, I was expecting the game to be totally rigged, so I kept being surprised. Because I thought, oh, surely this is the game where there will be a few people who end up over the winning corner and a whole bunch of people in the all winners corner. And so I was surprised as an observer that I was still hearing laughter and that people were participating and it seemed kind of evened out. So I wasn't seeing what I was expecting, which also surprised me.
My first thought was that you have a couple of plants to make mischief.
Ah. Maybe I do. No, the game makes its own mischief.
I think in the beginning, we didn't know what you guys were doing, but there was much more laughter in the beginning. It seemed more fun. And then it wasn't as fun.
Well, the laughter and the fun are two different things, right? Because the early laughter was kind of nervous.
Yes.
Like the one group just busted out laughing really loud. It felt like there was all this pent up emotion that came out as it's just laughter. Yeah. And some groups actually felt like they eased up as they went on. Like people would join those groups and it felt like there were a couple groups that was like, ah, come on, it's all crazy.
the longer you stayed at one spot, the easier it was for them just to give up. Somebody dominant came in.
Yeah.
Interesting. So it had less to do with who was in home place the longest and more to do with sort of the personalities of the people who arrived. Mm-hmm. If I just came in and said, I'm just going to assert how the game's going to go and I'm going to do it with a certain kind of nonverbal affect, and that's going to work?
Our table's rules stayed.
Our table's rules
really?
Stayed.
We did this a lot.
You did this?
We had similar people.
So you
we
did that
four
just
four
a lot?
They
ended with four of the same, so they were they felt justified in tagging on the table. This
they
is how we do it.
I didn't know they were
the rules.
I never
for a while.
I was
first.
I thought maybe I was misunderstanding the rules myself.
Yeah,
I
that was like. problem.
Sure, I must be the crazy one.
Right. So that's one source of a potential problem, right? So I think it's B. I just didn't listen well enough at orientation, or you know, I missed this in school. We don't really get culture classes per se, right? You get English classes, but we don't necessarily get, say, nonverbal communication classes, or you know, cultural communication classes. We're supposed to just pick this stuff up. So one of the places we turn to blame is ourselves and say, oh, I'm just a stupid instrument, I'm not getting this. What other causes are there? What other reasons are there for the things that go imperfectly in these kinds of situations? Get yourself out of the equation.
Someone manipulating it.
Okay. So it could be somebody who's operating in the circumstance for with motives that are different than what you thought they were. So no fault of yours, but somebody's being really successfully assertive in a situation, and that could change.
Well, I'm thinking about a novel, Giants in the Earth, where there's a key scene in there where this Norwegian immigrant is out on, the Port of Prairie, staking out land. And he's doing it in such a way that is very un-Norwegian. And his wife is horrified. She never quite forgives him for it. But it's like what happens is the rules are not what he's used to. And so he thinks, I'll make them myself. There's this dichotomy where if they're not what they were, then they're nothing, and I'm going to make them be myself. Mm-hmm. Rather than considering that there might even be something going on. Because according to the law, as it's set up in the territories of that time, he actually is breaking the law, but he's not even aware, he doesn't care. It's not what it was in Norway, therefore it's a wide open world. Let's go.
Let's go. We had some of that rationale there today, too.
There is you to blame, Jeff.
There is me to blame. And who am I in the real world? What's my equivalent in the real world?
Death.
Death? We're done.
This group, but you know, it's gonna be over in 15 seconds, and I get to start over. Yeah. You know? And so, I mean, I was more likely to give up if I was like, well, there's, you know.
I'm representing capricious circumstance, making it much less capricious than maybe it is in real life, and putting time limits on where ordinarily you can stay in a situation as long as you can stand.
Well, you might be stuck there.
Well, you're representing a president who can't understand.
I am. I don't want to do that though.
Come up with a version of the game that doesn't use a certain verb.
Oh, yeah. I noticed today as I was sorting the decks that four of the decks were from Trump casinos, too. So. But, you know, that's a really good job. I want to call your attention over here for a minute. It's just to think about what's happening when we're navigating with each other is we're trying for something we could call transcultural or intercultural or bicultural, and I love the noun fitness. And it really has three elements to it, and you can have any one of the three or two of the three, sometimes three of the three, but you don't necessarily have them all. And that what you were working out today were all three of these kinds of things. One way to think about these is to think about your very first serious romantic relationship. Bless you! As that you maybe got operational fitness in that relationship pretty quickly. Like you watched other people and saw, oh, okay, so we're dating now. It's like, I'm going to open the door. I'm going to put my hand out. I bet she's going to take my, okay, cool. And then if you start having a sexual relationship, your first one, you're thinking, well, operationally your body's work, you know what you're supposed to be doing. But in terms of how you're supposed to be thinking or how you're supposed to be feeling about it, it takes a while, right, to sort of grow into those things, to figure out those relationships. So I like that as an analogy for understanding these three things together. You can move in, a new international environment. You can learn how to get on the bus and get to your destination, but you may be puzzled every time you do it. You know, you don't understand it like a local would. And you might get there, you might understand it like a local would, but you still don't feel a lot about it like a local would. You don't respond emotionally to things. Especially when you move from a culture where, let's say, emotions are more reservedly expressed, and you find yourself in the midst of a culture where people do a lot of this kind of stuff just routinely with each other, and you just find yourself, just feeling like that a lot. I can move through the culture, like, I'm getting on the bus, But it takes a while to sort of sink into that final feeling of, you know, now when somebody like bumps up against me, it's going to go, hey, bump up against them, and I feel like they feel. So it's worth it to parse this kind of experience in terms of these three sorts of competencies. And notice it's not, I become competent in this other culture. What folks who study this are actually studying are the people who successfully straddle, who become bicultural. You start to feel as though you have more in common, and in fact you do have more in common with other bicultural people, regardless of which cultures they belong to, than you do with a member of one or the other of your two cultures. So once you have the experience of being bicultural, for example, people who had one sexuality early in life and they developed a different sexuality later in life or discovered a different sexuality later on, often understand the world in a way similar to somebody who was raised in one country and another country. There's that bi-ness that really does change how you move through the world. That's the name of this competency, is that what you're developing isn't the ability to disappear into a new culture, but that you're one of the people who can actually move really fitnessy.
Fluidly,
that's nice. In a new culture without necessarily abandoning the old one either. You've got them both.
But we have a country where a lot of people don't even have passports, haven't gone to another country,
right,
let alone lived in another country.
Right.
And so their view of the meaning of life and everything is...
Yeah. This is one argument people make for why we should have everybody learning at least one other language. Because when you're learning another language, you're often learning, well, why would they even focus on that with some words, you know? Well, they like these kinds of things, but they value that sort of stuff. You see those kinds of things.
Well, the other example I was going to give that demonstrates fitness of the lack of it is humor.
Yeah.
Humor is so contextual.
Yeah.
And both when we've had a foreign exchange student in our home or when we've been in other situations, and something is uproariously funny and you just don't get it. you don't know what's funny about.
You have to explain it to them.
Yeah.
And that's not funny.
Well, it's funny in a different way. I know a story of an American businessman giving a speech to a Japanese audience with a Japanese translator, and he had a mild joke in his speech. And you don't usually write jokes into speeches you're giving to Japanese audiences as a foreign national. He didn't know this. So he had this speech, he told his mild joke, and the audience just exploded, just laughed and laughed. And afterwards, he asked the translator, he said, "How did you translate my joke?" He said, "Oh, I said, the American gentleman has told a joke, he has laughed." Because exactly that. You have to have so many levels of meaning to get what's funny. You have to be so immersed in it, you have to have that cognitive fitness to really get what's funny. And often we just don't have that in that circumstance. There was another hand up. Somebody else wanted to say something before we move on. What was that?
Well, I just thought I'd respond a little bit. I mean, I agree 100% with what you say, but I find it just as hard, probably harder, to go between cultures here in the States than I do. I'm perfectly at home in much of Europe, even if I don't speak the language. Mm-hmm. But I'm not at home in the South. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
And so...
We have lots of experiences intra-culturally that strike us this way. That's one reason I wanted to seek out the examples, that there are so many things like that, that are like this experience. And you're absolutely correct that we aren't nearly as bi as we should be in our exposure to others in the world. It's one of the reasons we respond to others so easily as threats than as potential allies. I wanted to point out a couple different things about communication itself to finish the session here. One is, when we're talking with each other, when we're dealing with each other, we're really just dealing at the level of sensory cues, information that's available to my eyes, my ears, my touch, my nose. What am I seeing?
Taste.
Yes, that's a cue as well. So that we really only have verbal and nonverbal behavior available, and we've only got vocal and nonvocal versions of those. That's it. So what's an example of verbal-vocal behavior?
Hi.
Geez, well done. Yeah. So I might say something, right? I took that away, so you didn't have that one. How about vocal nonverbal?
Snort.
Huh? What?
Snort.
Snort, yeah.
Laughing.
What else?
Laughing.
Laughing. Uh-huh. But there are other things, too. There are other things as well.
Inflection.
Well done. How about volume? Do you read anything into volume? So we have all kinds of things we do with our voice, right?
Yes.
It involves our voice, but it's not involving words, so we have some things here. We have some things that are verbal and non-vocal.
Writing.
Well done.
Oh.
How about non-verbal, non-vocal? What are the things you paid attention to today, for example, when you sat down in a new group?
Gestures.
Eyes, body. Did you use touch at all with new people?
Mm-hmm.
No? Yeah, you're all pointing like, hey, stop. So we only have these cues. The thing I'd like you to notice is that these are messages, and sometimes we don't even know we're sending them. We aren't sending meanings. We're sending messages. People are making meanings, right? Mm-hmm. And what's important to know is that we're making meanings not only about the content of the message. Did you just say hi to me again?
Hi.
Caught it. Here it is. Now, that's, I'm understanding what that means, you know, at the content level. Oh, he's greeting me. That's a greeting. I know what to do with that. But you can also click on it, this little pop-up menu appears. And that's this stuff. Part of it's here. Part of it's the meta message, the message about the message. How am I supposed to take this message? Like you said, hi, and you said it pretty quick, and you had like a sparkle, and your eyebrows went up and stuff like that. But sometimes you'd say, like, I'd say, Kirsten, say hi to me, and she'd go, hi. You know, and you might get that response, and you'd think, huh, how am I supposed to take this?
Uh-huh.
So we have so we have these meta messages that tell us how we're supposed to take the message. We all knew when our parents were being serious with us, for example. What are the things parents do when they want you to take them seriously?
Take their full name.
Full name. Full name. Middle name was good.
Yeah.
Swear at me.
Swear at you.
Repeat.
Repeat. Absolutely. Some parents get louder, some parents get really quiet. But all these things worked as meta messages to say, here's, I'm telling you how to take the words I've just given you. I've just said hi to you, but here's how I want you to understand that. You know, this is a hi, where the hell have you been? And if they don't get the meta message, sometimes that's your next overt message, right? Like somebody says, how do I look? And you say, you look terrible. And they start weeping, and you say, I was kidding. It was a joke. You were supposed to take it as a joke, but you missed the meta message. So there's this. But what we're most interested in is this stuff. The reason that you might have felt uncomfortable during the game today had a lot to do with feeling like you're negotiating who you are and excuse me, what you're saying about the relationships you think you have, what you're announcing about the relationships you think you have with the other people that you're sitting down with. So we're not only negotiating message content, we're also negotiating people content. When I'm talking about relational messages, think of all the ways I could get you to shut the door. I could say, shut the door! And you might do it, right? But you think, ooh. I mean, in fact, you might not do anything about the door. You might just say, don't you talk to me like that. Right? You might explicitly address the relational message, and you'd set the content aside for a minute, which we do with each other a lot. But even if it's a relatively non-controversial relational message, we're always farming every little bit of communication for this stuff. You're doing it for me right now. You're thinking hard about, do I want to keep listening to this guy? You know, is he treating me all right? This, though, is the one that's really at the heart of what I think we're up to. When we're dealing with communicating across barriers, we're often really worried about how we're coming across. We're worried about what sort of identity we're constructing for the other person as well. And so one of the things we'll talk about when we meet on Friday is we'll talk some more about what it means if we start, if we just pretend, think about identity not as something that's personal and hidden and held, but something that's social, that my identity depends a lot on you. Right, that I'm always putting my identity out there and saying something like, right? And whether I see you're nodding back at me, and I think, oh, whew, she's nodding back at me. I must be kind of that person. So it's more social than personal. It's also something that's not static. It's identities are constantly being negotiated. It feels like, when you do a crazy arm thing with me? So when we first meet, just stand there, we'll just do this. So when we first meet, just do this with me. This is what it looks like. Is, you know, with this kind of negotiating stuff, now it's kind of coordinating. So, and we get together, and from the outside, it looks like let's stop. It looks like we stop. We just, now we're renegotiating in ways that are familiar to us. It's like we show up and say, hi, I know how to do this. So, think of communication as the center of your identity. It just means that we're always starting in kind of chaos, and we're eventually working to renegotiate things, but it never really stops. I think of it like a rock in curling. That a rock, if you kicked it, you know, it was just sitting there, you hurt your foot. But if it's moving along, all it takes is just a little melting around it, and it you know, it moves pretty significantly. So if you can think of your identity as something that's always in motion, that also makes it seem a little fragile, but also makes it seem kind of malleable, that you've got more agency about it. And that it's consequential. The things we do with each other personally tree out to the things that we do groupishly with each other, organizationally, culturally, that if you start to take seriously this notion that we are negotiating identities as we move through our life with each other, that we're doing it with each other, it's being negotiated all the time, and those things have consequences beyond just us. So that's the root of what we're doing on Friday. I wanted to ask you one last question. This, by the way, I'll come back to this on Friday too, but this is what it means in detail to think about a communication-centered theory of the self. What does it mean to be a person if you're seeing it as something that we're always negotiating? So it's got some layers and it can have some gaps to it. But I wanted you to ask, before we're done today, what made things go better? Excuse me, during the game that we did today, what did you notice that happened in any group that you were in that felt like it made things incrementally better for you or maybe everybody? What sorts of, doesn't matter how small, anything you could name that was specific and point to particular people if it helped, anything you saw or noticed that felt helpful?
Spencer and I realized, he realized just before I did, he was staring at me like really intently, and he wasn't staring at me like, oh my God, I can't believe you don't understand this. He was like, I know you'll get this, I know you'll get this. And it was like, wait a minute, something's going on now.
So like a focused, personal, encouraging look
was
something that did it. So something he did interpersonally really had something to do with helping.
So setting the rules, when as soon as everybody got to the table, Joel would, like he said, took the deck away, and then establish, here's the ace, high or low, and got the group consensus. And then, which one is trump? Is it diamond? Is it spade? And so,
great.
But that's good.
Okay. More things? And what helped?
Support from the group of origin. Yeah.
But how did you know? What counted as support?
Well, I didn't understand there were different rules until the whole thing was over.
That's crazy. But how did you know you were supported? That's what I'm asking.
Well, because we all, the people who had started together, we were all like telling someone else, non-verbally, we were all in agreement.
Okay.
So I knew that we were all on the same page.
Okay.
We were functioning in the same way.
So kind of verbalize, well, without verbalizing.
Non-verbal agreement.
Non-verbalizing your consensus was affirming. It's like,
oh,
good, it's not just me. Other people do this. Great, so some focused encouragement, some explicit rules negotiation early in the process, and the earliness probably mattered too. What else?
Finally just not caring.
Great. So something attitudinally, there was, some of the laughter got beyond sort of the, nervous, and into kind of a relaxed sort of, here comes the absurdity again. All right? So something attitudinally can make a difference. Anything else you noticed? What made things better? That you can't see personalities. What were you actually responding to?
Well, part of the group was the new group that came in where we had my first difference of rules.
Yeah.
I knew two of them. They were family members. And so that, I was responding to that. Like, what are you doing? You know, I was more critical of my family members than I was of people that I don't know what that is.
What made things go better for me might be different than what made things go better for the group.
Yeah.
But one thing that made things better for me was that she was more aggressive than I was. And so she would do this. So I could be, well, I'll just let them do it.
So there was certainty in other people's, let's say, assertiveness.
Right.
You're going to be that assertive. That's actually makes things easier for me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to care about this one. Anything else that happened? What'd you notice?
Kind of experimentation and trying to figure out the rules. Like when I got to this group, I was like, okay, I don't know the rules, so I would point to the guy if I thought it was winning, and then someone would be like, no, I win. I'm like, okay, all right, that's different. But I was kind of nonverbal questions, I guess, kind of trying to suss out what's going on just by trying out my own thing, and if it didn't work, I realized, okay, so that's not how we do things in this group.
So there was some process stuff up front. There was some Q&A stuff that happened without, again, you didn't have your words. But we still managed the forms of questioning and asking. How did you ask a question? What did that look and sound like when questions got asked in the groups you were in? How did you know you were being asked a question?
Raised eyebrows.
Raised eyebrows.
Tone of
vocal, nonverbal, right?
Pointing.
Stuff. Pointing.
Yeah.
Going like this.
Yeah.
So there's a theory that talks about intercultural adjustment, and actually it names all of the forces you've just named plus two more, and these might interest you. So when you're coming into a new culture and you're really trying to get enculturated, one of the forces that matters a ton that we don't look at a lot, we tend to put a lot on the sojourner, but we need to put a lot on the host. Actually, the environment has a lot to do with whether I'm going to successfully acclimate into my new group or not. For example, the U.S. culture, mainstream U.S. culture tends to make you really come around before I'm going to let you in. Like, we'll let you in once you've taken the trouble to learn our language and learn our norms, and then maybe we'll be okay. Other cultures are much more open than that. Mm-hmm. That just say, you're a stranger, oh, please come in. Yeah. Have my silverware. Join us. Teach us. And we're sort of the opposite. So that's one of the factors that matters a lot. And another one has to do with, let's call it local media. When you're adjusting to a new culture, it makes sense that you'd want to pay attention to, watch the news in the new culture, watch what counts as entertainment in that culture. It's interesting to watch American television, and put foreign eyes on, and just see what people think about us. Right, if you just watch those media. But the piece of this that's really interesting is if you're going to acclimate really well, you're also supposed to keep on paying attention to your home media. Like, keep reading the newspaper from your home country or your hometown or whatever. Keep Skyping with people from there. That's just as important to your bicultural adjustment in the new culture. I think the conventional wisdom is that we should cut it off and leave it behind, right? Like, no, make a clean break. Just really get into it. It's like, no, that actually doesn't work very well. You really have to maintain those connections with your own culture as well.
Reverse culture shock.
But why is that so helpful to understand?
Why is that so helpful? Because it reduces the amount of dislocation you feel. It reminds you of the ways you are anchored, and it gives you constant recursive reference points for your new experiences. It gives you a chance to compare those things back and forth. You watch American media and you wonder, does every piece of American entertainment media feature white people? Like, is everything set up to make sure the white person looks good or is funny or whatever? And then you look at media in other circumstances and you think, yeah, that is different. At least that's distinctive about American media. It's a good thought experiment, by the way, is to change the sex and the race of every commercial you watch or every billboard.
Jeff, is it possible to have too much connection with your mm-hmm. home culture?
Of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's not limited.
Has that been your experience?
It was my experience with our exchange student.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
No.
Yeah. There is this, and that's the last thing I think I'll say today to get you to Vespers on time, is that if you're thinking about where we're heading on Friday, the most fundamental shift to make in our thinking is to go from a place of, say, certainty and imposition, like I'm in a new situation. And this worked really well for you today. You talked, I'm sorry I don't know your name, but I took the cards and I made it
Kristen.
So this worked really well to say, you know what, I'm just going to do what I want to do in the situation and circumstances be damned, and it worked. They're great. And in many situations, cross-culturally, that doesn't work as well. And you know this. But that you're going from a position of, no, I'm really sure of how things are here, and I'm just going to impose and move there. The attitude I'm going to try and talk you into is one of, let's say, genuine curiosity, to go from certainty to curiosity, and to go from imposition to more of questioning, that I run up against something that I didn't expect to find. If I can talk my first response into being something like, oh, that's interesting, and to mean it, not like, oh, that's interesting, but to think, oh, cool new thing, like you were talking about, like, oh, cool, this group does it different yet, first thing I have to figure out. So there are things, we'll talk about things attitudinally and things you can actually do in action, and also some structural things that work better than other things do on Friday. So Friday's talk, by the way, I keep talking about it as though we're going to give a how-to. It's sort of a range between, at the one end it's saying, be respectful, go. That's the vaguest advice you could give, be nice. Go, there, you're all set. Or at the other end, you could get really behavioral, like remember, never move your arm like this more than 5 times in 10 seconds. And so what we're trying to do is strike a nice balance between the two. It's a little more specific than just be nice, be respectful. It's a lot less specific than something that might not work for you, right? You're going to be like trying on other people's clothes for a while until they feel like they fit you. So that's where we're headed on Friday. Thanks for coming for this. This is really